Astonishing Legends Network.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. We're going to get right into it, but first, I just want to make clear, some people have told me that in this episode, I get to a certain point where, weirdly, I leave the impression that actor Jason Priestley is dead. He is not. As far as I know, at the time of this recording, he is very much alive and well and doing great. So I just want to make that clear. He's doing fine. Everyone's doing fine. Jason, I had a great time meeting you, and let's get that dinner we talked about. All right, here we go. The Amityville Horror Conspiracy by Stephen Kaplan and Roxanne Salch Kaplan. The Amityville Horror Conspiracy is one of my favorite books of all time. And even though it was only ever published in paperback by Belfry Books on Halloween Day, 1995, it will always hold a place of honor on my paranormal bookshelf. Not because it's an expert example of real debunking, though it is, but because Stephen Kaplan's voice is so beautifully, achingly, heartbreakingly human. You see, Stephen is a parapsychologist who absolutely believes in ghosts and haunted houses. He just doesn't believe in the Amityville Horror. A single phone call with George Lutz in February 1976 sets him on a 20-year quest to tear the myth of the Amityville Horror a new asshole. From the jump, it's personal. Every article, every TV news story, every random comment he hears about the house at 112 Ocean Avenue stirs him into a barely contained rage of indignation. You want to talk haunted houses? Fine, he'll talk haunted houses. But do not mention that fucking Dutch colonial with the attic window eyes unless you want your face melted off. But why, you ask? Why was Stephen Kaplan so totally obsessed with disproving the story of the Amityville Horror? Well, for one thing, he was a parapsychologist. I don't mention this to explain his interest in a possibly haunted house. I mention it to illustrate a kind of personality. Look, parapsychology is a small world filled with vivid, eccentric characters, always has been. And here, I'm talking about the ones with public-facing operations, the ones who investigate hauntings and give lectures at the local public library and end up in the newspaper every year in late October talking about real-life ghosts and witches and vampires. Stephen Kaplan was one of those. And there's a healthy level of competition slash intense seething hatred among these people. How do I know this? I spent years working in community theater, and it was exactly the same. Each theater was its own fiefdom, usually run by some dude who was convinced that no one knew how to produce, direct, write, or act in theater but him, most especially the people at the nearest other community theater. You might think, wouldn't two community theaters be more successful if each one championed and supported the other? The answer was always a loud and resounding no. Why reach out a hand to help a bunch of talentless hacks when we're producing real art? Besides, there were only so many prospective audience members with a limited amount of money to spend on local theater. Everyone was fighting for the same prize in a zero-sum game. Keep in mind, this wasn't Broadway, it was community theater. The stakes weren't high, but the egos? In the stratosphere. Parapsychologists can be the same way. There's only so many research grants and poltergeists to go around. Stephen Kaplan's decades-long David and Goliath battle starts out innocently enough. On Monday, February 16, 1976, he receives a call from a seemingly terrified George Lutz. He wants Kaplan's group, the Parapsychology Institute of America, and how's that for a name, to investigate the house that he and his family abandoned the previous month. And to recap quickly, if you missed the last episode of this podcast and haven't participated in popular culture for about the last 50 years, the story of the Amityville Horror goes like this. On the night of November 13th, 1974, 23-year-old Ronald DeFeo murdered his entire family with a shotgun, both parents and four siblings, The murders took place in the family home at 112 Ocean Avenue in Amityville, Long Island. 13 months later, the Lutz family bought the house, and according to the book that was published in 1977, they experienced the wildest case of paranormal phenomenon this side of Skinwalker Ranch. They only stayed in the house 1 month, but that was enough. So when George Lutz called Stephen Kaplan for help, it was about 6 weeks after the family had fled. But they still owned the house and presumably wanted to know what in the literal hell was going on, and if it'd ever be safe to move back in again. They make a plan for Kaplan's team to do an overnight investigation. Kaplan assures Lutz there will be no charge. But, he says, if it's a hoax, I will not hesitate to expose it. Kaplan gathers two teams of 8 people each, made up of parapsychologists, psychics, photographers, and, quote, a few others. They'll be equipped with tape recorders, cameras, and debugging equipment. What this refers to in this context, I'm not really sure. On February 19th, the Long Island Press runs an article on Kaplan's group and their upcoming investigation. Later that day, George Lutz phones Kaplan back and calls the whole thing off. When Kaplan asks why, Lutz says that he and his family don't want any more publicity. Kaplan smells a rat. They've already had publicity. What's his investigation going to add? Kaplan accepts the dismissal, but then does something that tells you everything you need to know about him. He calls the Long Island Press, tells them what happened, and why he thinks it happened. The very next day, the press runs an article titled, "Ghost Hunter Smells a Hoax." 4 days later, Kaplan sees a local TV news feature about the house. Turns out, Ed and Lorraine Warren, the now famous married ghost hunter demonologist couple, have just held a séance in the house. It's on TV. Whatever happened to not wanting publicity? Now, I'm about to quote Kaplan at length, so let me help you out. I want you to picture him as Rainn Wilson, the guy who played Dwight Schrute on The Office. I can't really do a Rainn Wilson impression, and I don't know him, so unfortunately I couldn't just get him to do it for us. So you'll just have to try to picture it and hear it in your head. Here we go. Now, I'm nearly certain that the whole thing is a hoax. Why? Right off the bat, I can think of 2 good reasons. A, if it is a hoax, which I strongly suspect, I had told him I would expose it. And B, I made it plain to him that my services can't be bought. No wonder he dropped me. But he hasn't heard the end of me. I decide to do some investigating of my own. I don't know it yet, but I'm about to begin one of the most complex investigations of my career. The book that resulted from this investigation is a brilliant and detailed account of how a legend can take up residence in our reality, even when the truth is plain to see. But it's also a rare portrait of a man. Call him an idealistic David against an unstoppable Goliath. Call him a hero of parapsychology who didn't like seeing his field sullied with outrageous and obvious lies. Call him a petty, obsessed, self-important scold who decided to nurse a grudge only he knew about and turn it into a 20-year revenge trip. I call him one of the most fascinating figures in the history of parapsychology, because he did something the self-proclaimed skeptics almost never do. He did real investigatory work. He knew the field as well as the facts about the specific case he was trying to debunk. And he brought his receipts. And ladies and gentlemen, if that hasn't piqued your interest in Dr. Stephen Kaplan, I'll toss in one more little fact. He's a vampirologist. That's right. He's interviewed hundreds of self-proclaimed vampires and confidently assures us most of them aren't real. Most of them. In April of 2004, my agent asked me if I was interested in writing a remake of the Amityville Horror. Apparently, MGM was eager to restart the franchise. I wasn't, but to be fair, at that time, I wasn't interested in doing much of anything. It had been a year since the cancellation of my show Miracles, and I was still grieving, a luxury that I now see as wildly impractical. But that's where I was. The fact that I wasn't interested didn't stop me from telling my agent that I was very interested because, you know, money. I still had to make a living. So I told him I'd reread the book and we'd talk the following week. I ordered a paperback copy from Amazon, and Amazon thoughtfully stepped in, as it often does, and showed me some other titles I might like. And one of them was The Amityville Horror Conspiracy. And what first caught me about this book was that a full quarter of its cover featured the face of a non-famous person. Who puts their own picture on the cover of their book? I mean, unless they're Oprah or The Rock, what's the point? Now, some of you at home are asking, but Rich, didn't you put your name in the title of your podcast and you're not Oprah? All right, sit down. I bought Stephen Kaplan's book immediately. Plus, maybe it would give me a new angle on what was now a 25-year-old story. The following week, my agent and my lawyer reached out to me, but this time it wasn't about Amityville. They wanted to talk to me at the same time. It's hard to explain why this is so terrifying. It's like if two or more of your doctors want to talk to you at the same time. Rarely is it good news. As it turned out, they wanted me to seriously consider getting back into television. What are they, nuts? What do they think I've been trying to do for the last year? No, they didn't want me out there pitching my own ideas and trying to sell my own pilot. They wanted me to consider going onto the staff of someone else's show. I was a little taken aback. I had basically run the show I had created. Now they wanted me to take a step backward? A cut in pay and title? Yes, that's exactly what they wanted. We were in the middle of a thing that used to be called staffing season. That was a part of a thing that used to be called network television. April and May was when new and existing shows set their writing staffs for the upcoming season. An available writer might take dozens of meetings, hoping that even one would result in a job offer. It was a bit like musical chairs. Network TV shows' writers' rooms typically started meeting on June 1st. No one wanted to come out on the other side of Memorial Day weekend without an offer. So, was I ready to play? I was not. The idea of working for someone else on some show that would never be anywhere near as good and beautiful as Miracles was awful. I felt like a widower being urged back into the dating game. But why bother when the love of my life is dead? My agent and lawyer assured me that there were many, many shows that were extremely interested in meeting me. This, of course, is the equivalent of saying to that same widower, "But I know a ton of women who said they wanted to sleep with you." Sure, it made me feel wanted, but it also made me feel lost. Fine, fine, I'll go on these meetings, but I won't like it. The dating metaphor is not far off. Most of my meetings with showrunners that year took place in various Starbucks around the valley and West Side. It goes like this. They buy me a coffee. They ask me how the traffic was on my drive in, where I live. They tell me how much they loved Miracles. And then they talk about their show. Their hideous, awful, contrived, hacky, stupid, boring, ugly, dumb, evil shows that aren't mine. I smile and nod the way you do when someone shows you a picture of their hideous, awful, contrived, hacky, stupid, boring, ugly, dumb, evil baby. Yes, it's just like dating, only without the sex. Or in other words, for me, just like dating. The worst part is, I'll be signing away a year of my life. It feels like I'll be setting off on a whaling ship on a treacherous journey with a crew I don't know, and no sign of land for months. What if I hate it? What if the show is really bad? What if the people are mean? Worst of all, what if I don't get hired at all? At night, I settle down with The Amityville Horror Conspiracy. My agent has already told me not to bother preparing a pitch for the Amityville remake. A writer is already on it. That's fine. but I'm still consumed by Stephen Kaplan's diary of indignation and existential distress. Before starting it, I did reread The Amityville Horror. I loved that book when I first read it in 1978, but that was 25 years ago. And on this reading, I find it less compelling. I've read a lot of books about hauntings and poltergeists in the meantime, and now this book strikes me as too much of a good thing. I've also lived through the Amityville cottage industry of films and follow-up books. At least 10 books at the time of this writing, and 27 films. 27! James Bond only has 25. So the idea that this case is an unsullied example of true paranormal activity, well, I'm open to opposing views. For Kaplan, the bigger the Amityville story got, the more it galled him. But no matter how many radio show appearances he did, or how many newspaper articles he was featured in, there was just no way to get out in front of this story. It just kept growing bigger and bigger, like a peaceful surf that surges into a tidal wave, and then a tsunami. The 12 months following his first encounter with George Lutz are hard on Stephen Kaplan. He clashes with Ed and Lorraine Warren on the Long John Nabel program, a popular New York radio show back in the day. They insist the stories about the house being possessed by evil spirits are true. And even though he's gathering information from the Amityville Police Department and the local Long Island Press that support his suspicion that the Lutzes are lying about their house being haunted, the rumors are spreading like dozens of wildfires. And Kaplan's just one man. He can't put all of them out alone. His personal life is also in crisis. He's married with two young sons, but his marriage is starting to come apart. He's only 36, but his health isn't great. On July 2, 1976, he suffers a major heart attack that almost kills him and lands him in the hospital for 3 weeks. In February of 1977, he and his wife finally separate, and he moves out of his home into a small apartment. Soon after, he receives more bad news. A book based on the Lutzes' experience in their house will be published by Prentice Hall, and the movie rights have already been sold. In late March 1977, Stephen Kaplan contacts Prentice Hall and speaks with the Amityville Horror editor, Tam Mossman. He expresses his concerns that any book about the house in Amityville be published as, quote, nonfiction. He says he has reason to believe the story has been fictionalized, to say the least. Mossman explains that he's a friend of the author, Jay Anson, and that Anson merely wrote the book from tapes recorded by the Lutzes. And the editors at Prentice Hall have no reason to doubt their sincerity. Kaplan is outraged by this breezy disregard for even the most basic fact-checking, and frankly, so am I. Mossman says he'd be happy to send Kaplan the galleys as soon as they're ready. Kaplan accepts the offer knowing it's the best he's going to get for now. 6 months later, Kaplan receives an advance, hardback edition, and sees the words, "A True Story," emblazoned on the cover. For him, it's like a nightmare coming true in real time. When the dust settles on my TV staff writing meetings in late May 2004, I have a grand total of one offer. The show is called True Calling, and it's being renewed for a second season on Fox. I recall meeting with the showrunner, John Feldman. He seemed like a nice enough guy, but the writer's room will be in Santa Monica, which means 2 to 3 hours of commuting for me a day. And the premise of the show is a bit of a puzzle. I can tell it's not going to be easy for me. True Davies, played by Eliza Dushku, is a young woman who works in the city morgue. One day, something weird happens. One of the corpses suddenly turns to her and says, "Help me." And then her day rewinds to the moment she woke up. And her task in this newly rewound day is to somehow find that person and intervene in their life so that they don't die. Couple more things. This do-over day also gives her a chance to intervene in the lives of her friends and family and influence the events they experienced that day. Plus, it obviously gives her a chance to redo events in her own life on that same day. You still with me? Okay. Halfway through the first season, a character named Jack Harper is introduced, played by the always welcome Jason Priestley. Jack is a mysterious loner whose job seems to be to thwart True's efforts and make sure the day plays out the way it did the first time, but we don't know why. Okay, it feels daunting, and it doesn't feel like it plays into my strengths as a writer, which has never been clever plotting. On the other hand, it's not my show. All I have to do is help. I'll be one of eight people. I figure I can do 1/8 of anything. How hard can it be? My first day on True Calling is Tuesday, June 1st, 2004. The chairs we sit in that first day become our chairs forever. John is at the head of the conference table, and moving clockwise, it's me, Jane Espenson, Doris Egan, Corrine Rosenthal, Rob Doherty, Zach Estrin, our writer's assistant, Stephanie Williams, and Scott Shepherd. Each one of them is a legend, or soon to be, but I don't know that yet. The only one I do know is Zach Estrin. He worked with me on Miracles, and he was one of the strongest voices urging me to join up on True Calling. Zach assures me I'll be able to write the show. I don't quite believe him, but having at least one friend in the room really helps. For some reason, I expect to be met by the other writers with skepticism and cold indifference. After all, I'm the new guy, or so I thought. As it turns out, Jane and Corrine are new guys too. And I am welcomed so warmly by everyone, it makes me feel a little ashamed to have expected anything less. Jane drags me into her office like it's our first day in the college dorms and shows off all her furnishings and then immediately encourages me to decorate my own office with personal stuff. Some writers think it's bad luck to decorate your office, but not me, she says. It's true. Writers tend to be superstitious, and the prevailing wisdom is, don't bring anything more than a single box of stuff to any job. That way, when you're fired, you can be gone in minutes. I know some writers who never bring anything more than a sweater. But I soon learned that Jane is anything but superstitious, and also very unlikely to be fired. If I'm going to be here every day, she says, I want to be happy. This is an excellent philosophy for working on a television show, and also for being alive. For those of you who have never worked in a writer's room, let me break it down for you. The hours are roughly 10 to 6, and the first order of business is always lunch. A binder goes around with menus from local restaurants. First, we have to all agree on a restaurant. This can take a while. Then we all have to figure out what to order. This also requires a lot of skill, focus, and self-knowledge. But finally, once the important work is done, we turn our attention to the episode at hand. First day is usually about trying to remember what the show's supposed to be about, how you ended last season, if there was one, and broad thoughts about what the upcoming season should be about and where the story and the characters should go. The rule of thumb in television writing is start big and work small. First, you figure out the season, the big moves, important character milestones, where you want to be halfway through the season, where you want to be at the end. All this gets discussed and decided, sometimes over the course of weeks, before anyone gets near writing the first episode of the season. But, because it's June 1st, and production is slated to begin in mid-July, we don't have the luxury of time. So, we jump straight into breaking the first episode of season 2. This is problematic for me. I'm not centered into the world of the show, and I'm definitely not at home in its weirdly specific episodic structure. So, I'm pretty quiet the first 2 weeks. I leave it to the experts who were here last year: John, Scott, Zach, Rob, and Doris. They've done this before. I need some time to get oriented. To keep myself occupied while I listen and learn, I find myself freehanding mazes on the backs of schedules and memo sheets. I'm following every word everyone is saying, I just need something to do with my hands, to cover my nerves. Over the years, I've seen writers do everything from knitting to lanyard making to sketching portraits of the other writers. For some reason, I'm drawing mazes. But behind all of this, another song is playing in my head. And the title of that song is, "Why Is My Show Miracles Dead While This One Lives?" Who will ever remember my show? One day, Doris Egan tells the room that she's just bought a new sideboard. Rob Doherty looks at her shocked. "You bought a cyborg?" This becomes a joke we revisit every day. "Hey Doris, how's your cyborg working out? Have you found a nice place for your cyborg?" She amplifies the joke by pretending not to hear it. "You know, it was handcrafted by Amish woodworkers over 100 years ago. I spent the weekend rubbing every inch of it with linseed oil. Worked up quite a sweat." And Zach does this thing. He'll wait until someone says a word that ends in ER. A helicopter, doppelganger, velociraptor. And then he'll repeat it loudly in an outraged tone. It's a variation on the old joke. "Caesar? I barely know her." He drops the "I barely know her" part because it's implied. But just saying a word and doing it randomly throughout the day has a strange comedic effect. First, you just smile. Yeah, we get it. Then it's a little annoying. But after a few hours, it becomes mind-shatteringly hysterical. And somehow, he's able to wait just the right amount of time for us to forget about it. Then suddenly it's escalator, hoarder, Vancouver. It turns out when you're tired and stressed, and your friend just won't stop doing an old joke, there is nothing funnier. Say it with me. Funnier. My favorite part of each day comes around 3:30. Our office building is at one end of Bergamot Station, a collection of small art galleries that's bordered on the far side by the Santa Monica Metro Station. 3:30 is when John leads us all down to the coffee place, and we get a snack and a flavored coffee drink and work outside at a patio table for a while. It's fresh air and sunshine, and you can smell the ocean from here. This strikes me as a very humane habit. I never did anything like this on Miracles, but I think I'd like to do it on my next show, if I ever have a next show. My drink is an iced chocolate mint mocha, which is also Jane's drink. I'm scared a lot on this job, but more and more, I'm happy too. In these first few weeks, I also struggle with deep feelings of emasculation. What am I doing on someone else's show? Shouldn't I be the boss? One night, I literally dream that my penis falls off, and when I find it and try to reattach it, I look down and realize it's not my own. My therapist just smiles when he hears this. It's so obvious, it's not even worth discussing. In the chapter of Stephen Kaplan's book entitled A Publishing Horror, he goes through the just-released Amityville Horror hardback first edition, page by page, pointing out a range of errors and questionable facts. Let's start with the most obvious. On page 2 in the preface, it states that the Lutzes moved into the Amityville house on December 23rd. But 3 pages later, when the diary-style chaptering begins, the book states they moved in on December 18th, and this is where the 28 Days of Terror begins, with the Lutzes fleeing in terror on either the morning of January 14th or 15th. Again, the narrative contradicts itself on these dates. Kaplan scores by pointing out how sloppy the editorial oversight of this supposedly true story is. He moves on to question the veracity of, quote, Sergeant Al Gianfrido, the pseudonym given for Sergeant Pat Camarado of the Amityville Police Department. There are repeated references in the book to the police sergeant visiting the Lutz's home. But Kaplan spoke to Camarado personally months earlier and was told firsthand by the sergeant that he had never stepped foot on the property at 112 Ocean Avenue during the entire time the Lutzes lived there. This feels like pretty basic stuff to check out. but the editors at Prentice Hall didn't bother. If they're not getting the easy stuff right, how are we supposed to believe that all the toilets really turned black? Later, Kaplan questions some of the phenomenon the Lutzes claim to have experienced. Case in point, George Lutz's famous story about how on the night of January 6th, he saw his wife Kathy levitating 2 feet off their bed. When George turns the lights on, he sees that Kathy has turned into a 90-year-old woman. Kathy drops to the bed, wakes up, and rushes to the bathroom. But by the time she looks in the mirror, all that's left of this strange illusion are, quote, deep lines in her face. Kaplan generously suggests that these could be lines you sometimes get on your skin from lying on wrinkled sheets. I find it endearing that he gives events like this the benefit of the doubt rather than just saying, this is obviously made up bullshit. A while later, though, he's going to discover that that is exactly what most of the book is. The first true calling episode I take an active role in breaking is episode 204, the fourth episode of the second season. It focuses on our nemesis, Jack, and in a twist, it is his day that rewinds. For some reason, this makes it easier for me to focus on the premise because it's happening to someone else for the first time, almost like the pilot of a spinoff. I pitch like crazy all week. Now, according to the batting order, this is supposed to be Rob Doherty's episode. But I'm one of the few writers who actually likes pitching, so Scott Shepard, our second in command, encourages me to do it when it's time for John to hear it. I do. John loves it. He pulls me aside into his office afterwards and tells me that I'll be writing the episode. I panic. I'm not ready for the high dive. But it's Rob's, I remind him. He tells me it's okay. Rob and I'll switch places. I check in with Rob. Is he okay with this? Being the unfailingly kind person he is, he says he's okay with it. He says the episode is a weird one and it was freaking him out anyway. I'm relieved. You seem to get it. You can have it, he said. He's probably just being nice, but I decide to believe him. Some nights, when I pass John's office on my way out, I hear him on the phone with the studio or the network, and the calls never sound fun. I remember those calls. It's one thing I don't miss about running miracles. As I cross the parking lot to my car, I think, maybe not being the boss isn't so bad. It's the last week of August, and I'm in Vancouver for the filming of my episode. Back home in Los Angeles, it's scorching. But up here in Canada, it's cold and raining. I'm on set all day, a downtown street corner, under a rain canopy. Jason Priestley and Eliza Dushku are out in the downpour. I mean, they are literally getting soaked. Take after take after take. And between every single take, a horde of teenage girls runs up to Jason. And he signs autographs and poses for pictures, right up until they call action. When they call cut, it starts all over again. This goes on for hours, and not a single fan went away disappointed. Late in the day, it's getting dark, and I wander through the maze of trucks and trailers looking for the bathroom. A figure steps out of the last trailer in a long row, all the way up against a chain-link fence under a bridge. It's Jason Priestley, just heading back to set. This is the first time we're actually face-to-face since I've been up here. I have the same moment of panic I have whenever I encounter an actor. But he smiles, and he says, Richard, Mr. Miracles! He comes up and hugs me, and I'm so taken aback that he remembers me and my show, I choke up on a wave of emotion. We talk about meeting when he auditioned for Miracles just 2 years ago, and how strange our lives are, and how you never quite know what's coming. For some reason, I find myself telling him how sad I am that Miracles is gone. Then I tell him how happy I am working on True Calling. Both statements are true, but I have never said either out loud. He's been through cancellations too. We talk about how lucky we are to be here. It's nice to know someone out there wants you, isn't it? He says. It's nice to work. I get what he means. You don't always have to be the star. Sometimes it's okay to just be part of the team. He's not being modest. He's dead serious. I think about him signing those autographs in the rain. We hug again and make a plan to get dinner before I leave town. But it doesn't happen. And that's the last time I see him. And that was 20 years ago. From the day it is published, September 13th, 1977, The Amityville Horror is a mega bestseller. The publicity is such that there's almost no one in America or the world who hasn't at least heard about the haunted house on Long Island. It's a familiar punchline in Johnny Carson's monologues. And now, late July 1979, it's about to be released as a major motion picture starring James Brolin, Margot Kidder, and Rod Steiger. This is a bad week for Stephen Kaplan. His nonstop efforts to spread the truth about the Amityville Horror have largely been ignored. Jay Anson and the Lutzes, meanwhile, have participated in the onslaught of publicity for the movie. They've become B-list celebrities, appearing on The Mike Douglas Show and The Merv Griffin Show, among others. George and Kathy are in the process of writing three more books about their ghostly experiences, claiming that the demons of Amityville have followed them 3,000 miles to California. Kaplan is a voice in the darkness, a Don Quixote tilting at a haunted windmill. He's a candle in the wind. Then something amazing happens. From his book, quote, "Today, the official opening day for the Amityville Horror movie is also, ironically, a day of major triumph for me. I got the shock of my life when I picked up today's New York Post and saw this headline on page 5. Lawyer claims Amityville book was hokum, not horror." Kaplan is thrilled. He knows about the lawyer, William Weber. Weber represented Ronald DeFeo when he went on trial for the murder of his entire family. Kaplan continues reading the article, explaining, "Mr. Weber's story goes something like this. Weber had decided, after Ronald DeFeo's trial, to write a novel based on the murders in Amityville. The Lutzes told Weber of strange things that were happening in the house, though it doesn't explain how the Lutzes knew Weber in the first place. Weber thought that the Lutzes' story might make a good epilogue to his novel, so he interviewed them. Weber claims that after 41 hours in their company, he decided they weren't telling the truth, but that didn't matter since his book was a novel anyway." Kaplan is, of course, thrilled. Finally, vindication. The bulk of the book's second half is devoted to a chapter entitled "The Joel Martin, William Weber Tapes, August 5th, 1979. It consists of a 45-page transcript of a radio show in which the host, Joel Martin, interviews William Weber, who insists that the entire story was invented by him and George and Kathy Lutz, quote, "over many bottles of wine." On the radio show that night, we learned that according to Weber, he was approached by the Lutzes because, as Ronnie DeFeo's lawyer, they thought maybe their haunted house story could help his case. Maybe something about the house made Ronnie kill his family. But why would the Lutzes want to help the defense of a man who murdered his entire family, and whose trial had already concluded? Well, again, according to Weber, it wasn't so much about providing information to Weber as getting information from him, information that might help them build out their ghost story, which they had already planned to sell. The more they knew about the secret details of the DeFeo case, for instance, who was killed where, in what room, how, what time, and in what position, they could then have the paranormal phenomenon in their book echo the facts of the actual tragedy that took place in the house. Weber was only too happy to share that information. He was still under the impression that the Lutzes were in fact helping him with his book. Weber eventually wrote up a contract for the Lutzes to sign. But then, the Lutzes suddenly pulled out of the deal, and soon after, it was announced that Jay Anson would be writing the story of the Lutzes' paranormal experiences for Prentice Hall. The Lutzes then sued Weber, and anyone else who claimed any rights to any part of any story involving them or their experiences in Amityville, because now they were going to tell that story. Weber countersued for a share of the profits from the book that was eventually published because, according to him, he helped them invent it. For those listeners interested, the details of all of this legal wrangling have been deeply researched and reported on and debated online for the last 30 years. So if you want to know more, pro or con, please hop on your computer and have at it. The important thing is that Kaplan is finally getting his moment in the sun. Everything in his life is getting better. He's in the early stages of a new relationship, this one with Roxanne Salch, his co-researcher and assistant, and the co-writer of this book. He does multiple interviews over the next 2 months, trumpeting his claims about the Amityville horror hoax, and people are finally listening. It seems that with the arrival of the movie, suddenly, every media outlet is now more than willing to make as much of the hoax as they were of the original story. Kaplan's victory tour includes a face-to-face debate with Amityville champion and perpetual nemesis, Lorraine Warren. There is no love lost between these two ghost-hunting OGs. Facing off on WNEW-TV's Midday show, Kaplan uses Weber's recent, quote, confession as ammunition against Warren and her husband Ed's assertions that everything that happened in the Amityville house is true. For the first time, Lorraine Warren backs down. She claims that they never said the book is true, and that obviously literary license was used. The Warrens only said their own experiences in the house were true. And what were those experiences? Bad feelings, cold spots, and the sense that demonic forces were present. Kaplan takes the win. My first week back in Los Angeles after filming in Vancouver feels like my first real week on True Calling. I've now successfully made it through one cycle. Board break, pitch, outline, script, and shoot. I feel good. It all went better than I ever would have expected 3 months ago when I started. The Friday before Labor Day weekend, John takes us all out to lunch at the Buffalo Club. Very fancy. Some of us get a cocktail even though it's only noon, and we're technically working. The mood is relaxed and expansive, and I find myself talking openly about my recent divorce and the various realities that come with it. Alimony, child support, custody arrangements. People listen, fascinated. It's an experience none of them have had. Yet. John smiles at me and announces, "You have grown-up problems." The way he says it, it sounds like a compliment. The following Friday, a cold wind blows through our offices. John has heard a strange and disturbing rumor. Our fall time slot appears to have been given to another show. Or not. Our original order of 13 episodes might get cut to 6. Or not. It's unclear where the rumors are coming from, and John is unable to get anyone from the studio to return his calls. When he finally does, all they tell him is that they're trying to get confirmation too, but the network, Fox, isn't talking. We all go home for the weekend in a haze of unanswered questions and low-key dread. On Monday, our worst fears are confirmed. The second season order has indeed been cut to 6 episodes. The show is effectively canceled. Since we're about to shoot episode 6, we immediately stop working on the new stories we've been developing. Episode 7 has been written. 8 is in outline, and 9 is on the board. None of these will advance. The room continues to meet throughout the week, but mostly to commiserate and try to wrap our heads around the fact that we're all now out of work. John is gut-punched. The only explanation he was given, secondhand from the studio, was that the network suddenly decided the show was too niche and its audience would never grow. Of course, that wasn't how they felt 3 months ago when they renewed it for season 2. Someone else heard a rumor that over the summer, Fox had purchased no less than 40 reality show concepts that they were putting into immediate development. The amount of primetime real estate for scripted shows had therefore shrunk dramatically. Whatever the exact cause of death was, we never knew for sure. All we knew was that the, quote, extended daily dinner party of our writer's room, as Scott Shepard called it, had come to an end. It was time for everyone to gather their coats and be on their way. Last May, the idea that True Calling had been given a second season and Miracles had not filled me with rage and grief. Now, that second season had been cut short. The show was canceled, just like Miracles, and I am devastated. It takes Jane and I most of one morning to empty our offices. Framed pictures and posters, lamps, chairs, rugs, plants, books. But it allows us time to process the transition from work to unemployment that TV writers have always made. We all promise to keep in touch, and in a rarity for our profession, we actually do. Over the next 20 years, on various shows or just random reunions, we all stay in touch and work together. I end up doing one show with Scott, one with Rob, one with Jane and Zach, one with Jane and Corrine, and for years, John, Scott, Zach, Rob, and I met for dinner at least twice a year, every year, until last year, when, shocking us all, Zach suddenly passed away, leaving all of us with a hole in our hearts forever. On August 31st, 1979, Stephen Kaplan debates George Lutz himself on Connecticut's WTIC radio program with Brian Dow. In a TKO, technical knockout, if you'll allow me a sports reference, which you should not allow me, Kaplan gets Lutz to admit that Kathy never levitated 2 feet off the bed, and corners him into confirming that Jay Anson exaggerated the truth throughout the book for dramatic effect. Kaplan's book more or less ends on Halloween night, when he and Roxanne are invited to a costume party at none other than 112 Ocean Avenue. They, along with the house's new owners, Jim and Barbara Cromartie, and a few others, party like it's 1979. The book includes numerous photographs of the party inside the Amityville house, including the costumed guests posing in the famous Red Room off the basement, really just a storage nook barely large enough for one person to stand in. It's a well-earned victory lap, and it's hard not to smile and give Dr. Kaplan his due. Partying in the Amityville house is about as close as you can get to pissing on your enemy's grave. Kaplan is happy to report that there are no more cold spots in the house. It is filled with warmth and light and laughter and love. In the epilogue to his book, Kaplan sums up his experience with the Amityville Horror like this. All through the years, acquaintances and media contacts have always asked me the same question. Why? Why, Kaplan, do you persist in pursuing this case to expose it as a hoax? I have been told that I should not waste my precious time and energy on something that most people already know is nonsense. Most of all, I have been told that no one cares. Well, Kaplan cared. He cared enough to spend the next 15 years completing the manuscript for the book and fighting to get it published. Those 15 years were also spent continuing a life well lived. He and Roxanne eventually married and had 2 daughters, and together they continued the work of the Parapsychology Institute of America. Kaplan continued to write, teach, research, and investigate in his field. And ultimately, he would live just long enough to know that his life's work would eventually see the light of day. On June 9th, 1995, just 4 months before publication of the Amityville Horror Conspiracy, Stephen Kaplan died of a sudden heart attack. Again, from his epilogue, My original goal to stop all the hoaxers from making money off the Amityville Horror has been a failure. The legend continues to grow all over the world, where the name of the sleepy Long Island town is now synonymous with the word horror. I'm sure the legend will outlive me by far. But I wrote this book because I sincerely believe that the public has the right to know the truth about parapsychology. Unless people in our field speak up, parapsychology will continually be misused by phonies trying to make money off of other people's misfortunes. The irony is, I know that some cases of ghosts and hauntings are real. I have experienced them firsthand. But what was conjured up by the Lutzes, Jay Anson, and the others should only be classified as science fiction, or in some cases, merely trash. Our deepest thanks to everyone who has helped us keep the faith over the long years, and a special thank you to all of you out there who still believe that truth is the American way. 6 weeks after our last day on True Calling, I have a meeting on another show in the same building where our offices were. I'd been on several meetings and was about to begin the phase of my career that would be characterized by working on other people's shows. True Calling had proven to me that I could do it, and like Jason Priestley said, it's nice to work. After the meeting, instead of going straight to my car, I turn down the hallway and head up the stairs to get a look at the old True offices. I know it'll make me sad, but I do it anyway. When I get up there, I peek into the writer's room. It is now dark and silent and empty. I think about the 100 days we spent there, laughing and talking and creating with each other. "Hey, Rich," I jump. John is standing there in the hall behind me. "What are you doing here?" I ask him. He smiles a little ruefully. "Working on True Calling." I still don't get it. We walk back into his office. He explains that post-production is still going on. He's making cuts and doing mixes and having notes phone calls with the very network that canceled the show, and he is doing those notes on episodes that might never be aired. Of course, I feel stupid for not realizing that even after we all left, he's still preparing the body for burial. He says it was still important for him that the second season be good. We have fans out there. He owes it to them to give them the best final 6 episodes he can. I nod. He asks if I've been on meetings, and I feel ashamed to admit that I have. And he congratulates me and is genuinely supportive. He knows the drill. We talk a little longer and then run out of things to say, and I stand up to go. "Well," I offer lamely, "good luck with the episodes." He nods, and neither of us can quite ignore the tone implicit in my comment that I have moved on. "You know," he says, not intending to judge or condemn, but rather just to acknowledge something that has only recently occurred to him and took Stephen Kaplan a lifetime to learn. "It's hard," he says, "to be the last person to care about something." Thank you for joining me on Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf. Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf is presented by Astonishing Legends, 134 West, and Summerland Entertainment. Executive producers, Scott Philbrook, Forrest Burgess, and Susan Lambert. Our associate producer is Tess Feifel, and our sound designer, engineer, and editor is Kevin Ducey. Artwork is by Tommy Beaver, website is by Kayla Lord, and our music, as always, is by Nima Kazaruni. Please join us next time as we travel back to 2001, where we'll talk about a book by D. Scott Rogo called Miracles, a TV pilot I wrote, also called Miracles, and the beginning of a year in my life when everything changed. Until then, be safe and be well, find the light in the dark, and we'll see you again soon.